This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest Ron Suskind's new book, The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, has sent shockwaves through Washington with explosive allegations about the Bush administration's conduct in planning and justifying the war in Iraq. One of the most controversial charges is that the White House ordered the CIA to fabricate a document linking Saddam Hussein with the 9/11 attacks. On Tuesday, the day the book came out, two of the intelligence officials Suskind cites as sources for the story disputed his account of their words and actions. We'll ask Suskind about that a little later in our interview. Suskind is the former senior national affairs writer for the Wall Street Journal, where he won the Pulitzer Prize in 1995. Among his earlier books are The Price of Loyalty and The 1% Doctrine. Well, Ron Suskind, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your new book, The Way of the World, has gotten a lot of attention for this remarkable story of the chief of Iraqi intelligence and what he revealed in the months before the United States invaded Iraq. And you have several on-the-record sources from American and British intelligence confirming this. And the story really begins in the fall of 2002 with what you call a liberating admission. We don't know. What didn't they know?
At that point, Dave, there was a recognition in the intelligence operational part of these intelligence services in Britain and America that there's a lot of assumption, but there's not any hard evidence, real hard evidence in terms of this case for war. And a couple of the intelligence chiefs get together, the guys who had the Mideast divisions for the U.S., for CIA, and for MI6, the British Foreign Intelligence Service, and they kind of put their heads together. And the British guy, Michael Shipster's his name, he's quite a character, says, well, you know, actually I know somebody. I have a relationship that might be helpful. He's had a kind of gentleman's relationship with a guy named Habush, Tahir Jalil Habush, who's the head of Iraqi intelligence. He's their George Tenet. And what they hatch is a plan. It's supported by the U.S. It's kind of almost a joint effort. Our guy, Rob Richer of CIA, has a special relationship with the King of Jordan. He helped with the King of Jordan's arrival in office, and their buddies. And so it's set up in Amman, Jordan. That's where they'll meet. And a secret mission, a secret back channel is opened in January, early January of 2003. Between Michael Shipster, representing the U.S. and America essentially, and Habush.
And
they start to meet.
And Habush is then the sitting head of Iraqi intelligence, right? He is not
sitting
a former
head.
Right?
Now, sitting head of Iraqi intelligence.
So they begin these meetings in Amman, Jordan. Does Saddam Hussein know they're happening?
Well, you know, that's a debate that goes on, and I show that in the book. Generally they're not sure. Habush may have inferred he does know, but it's part of the debate that rages around Habush at the top of the British government and certainly at the top of the U.S. government. What's clear early on is that Saddam Hussein would never authorize some of the things that Habush is saying to a Shipster and essentially to the heads of both the U.S. and British governments about Saddam, not just that there's no WMD, which he lays out. And mind you, he's got a special position as the head of Iraqi intelligence. He actually oversees the biological program, which there isn't one since the mid-90s. Beyond that, though, after he lays out that part, he brings us into the mind of Saddam Hussein at this period. And everyone agrees that that is rich and at that point unmatchable intelligence.
So when this head of Iraqi intelligence sits down with a ranking British intelligence official prepared to relay this information to the United States, he wants to make a deal. He wants to be taken care of in the event of an invasion. And he gives them information about weapons of mass destruction. How does the subject come up? What does he tell them?
Well, interestingly, he wonders if the U.S. is serious about invading. He said Saddam Hussein doesn't really buy it. He says, why would anyone want this country? It seems like you guys didn't want it before. Islamic extremism, you know, especially armed with destructive weapons, which seems to be the big issue after 9/11, that's not here. We don't really have those kinds of extremists in Iraq. They're up in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the tribal areas. He can't figure it out. Beyond that, he's really fearful, Habush tells Michael Shipster, the British intelligence chief, who of course tells the rest of us, that Saddam is really fearful of the Iranians and their nuclear program. And he doesn't want them to understand, to know that he's a toothless tiger, that he doesn't have WMD. That's his real fear. All of this is expressed. At that point, it's carried up the ranks in the British side. And of course, it's carried up to the White House on the U.S. side in January of 2003. Now, this is before the President's State of the Union address with the famous 16 words, and it's certainly well before, a month before, Colin Powell goes before the UN.
And let's just be clear about this. You know that this is what Habush said, and you know that it went to the White House. How? From what sources?
There are many sources on this, but there are two on-the-record sources of two people integrally involved in the book. One of them is Rob Richer, who is head of our Mideast division. He was Shipster's partner, essentially, in setting the thing up. He's a longstanding intelligence professional with a long history. And also John McGuire, who is in the book, and he's the head of all CIA operations in Iraq. He's head of the Iraq Operations Group, so-called. Again, a longstanding CIA professional. And those two men are on the record. They're backed up by folks off the record, but on the record, they're quite clear about what we were learning and how we reacted to it in the CIA and in the White House.
Did either of them personally brief either President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, or Colin Powell?
I don't get into all of the who briefed whom, but the fact is both men were regular briefers of the president, the vice president, folks at the Department of Defense, NSC. They're two real stars at the CIA.
And so when this information comes to the White House that the chief of Iraqi intelligence is telling them, Saddam has no weapons of mass destruction but wants to make the Iranians think so, how do they react?
Well, at the start, when it first starts coming through, there's great consternation. Now, some of these things are already widely assumed or areas of suspicion. You know, the whole idea that everybody thought there were weapons and nobody knew, that's shown in the book not to be true. There was a lot of suspicion that there was nothing there prior to this period, coming through 2002. What happens at that moment is that Bush essentially says, oh gosh, he's saying there's no WMD. Why doesn't he give us something we can use for our case? That's his first reaction. The consternation inside of the White House and inside of CIA is really quite fascinating to watch and to see unfold, because on one hand, you've got this guy who is absolutely without peer in terms of providing a window, as John McGuire and other folks at CIA say, into Saddam Hussein. This is a rare opportunity because we can put disinformation through that window. We can manipulate Saddam, and even we might get Habush armed with some people to take Saddam out. As McGuire says, the CIA chief, he says we could walk to Baghdad instead of fight our way to Baghdad if we decide to go forward. Meanwhile, on the other side, the fact that he's saying there's no WMD is creating great confusion and concern. Those two sides, really the left hand and right hand of the United States at this point, are in a way in conflict here with competing agendas.
The two sides being the White House and what, the intelligence community?
Being the intelligence operatives who want to essentially carry forward the intelligence mission to use Habush no matter what, to maybe help U.S. troops if we go forward, to manipulate Saddam, maybe have him taken out, and the people who are quite sensitive in the White House especially about the fact that Habush is saying there are no WMD. There are two camps, if you will. And that second camp, the oh my God, he's trashed our case for war, ultimately that half ends up triumphing. What occurs here, Dave, is that in February, after many meetings in January, phone calls between Shipster and Habush, Richard Dearlove, the head of British intelligence, flies to the United States to hand the report directly to George Tenet. And he does his briefing. Dear Love is quoted widely in the book as to the British reactions at this point. Tennant turns to Rob Richer.
And Tennant here is the head of the CIA at the time. Right?
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. George Tennant, head of the CIA, turns to Rob Richer, one of his deputies, the head of the Mideast Division, says, wow, they're not going to like this downtown. And, of course, downtown means the White House. And he's right. He brings it to the White House. Here it is, the definitive report. Condoleezza Rice says, what the hell are we supposed to do with this, George? She has no love for Tennant. And the president, vice president, everybody are briefed.
You mentioned this fellow, Richard Dearlove, who was a high-ranking British intelligence official.
He's the head of British intelligence.
Now retired, right?
Now retired, 2004.
Whom you interviewed at his office in Cambridge, as I recall, right?
That's right. He's the master of Pembroke College at Cambridge.
So he personally goes to Washington. Is it his view with that trip that this guy, Habush, is serious, he is credible, we should believe what he's telling us, that they don't have WMD?
It's an intelligence mission. There's never anything that's absolutely ironclad and definitive in missions like this. What Dearlove believes and what the British believe is that this is a very, very credible offering of unique intelligence that certainly should affect these issues of whether we go to war. He says in the book, this was a bit of a kind of last chance for us to exert the intelligence function, find out what's known and knowable, and diffuse the situation, as he put it. And there's hopes on the British side. They're not anxious to go to war so much like we are, and people talk about that.
And so when it goes to the White House, what happens to the whole thing?
Well, it's briefed up, and at that point, the channel to Habush is cut off. Folks in the CIA operations area, folks are dealing with this run to war and how are we going to own this country and maybe could we take Saddam out. They're livid. Like, you know, no matter what the guy says about WMD, don't cut the channel off just because he's saying what you don't want to hear, meaning you, the White House. But they do cut off the channel. Not that we lose touch with Habush, because we've made a deal with Habush that we – when we invade, if and when, that he will make it safely out of the country and into a safe house. And that's where it stands in early February. We officially cut off the channel, but Habush has his bargain to be carried out.
Now, since we're in the early stages of the release of your book and government officials are reacting harshly and strongly denying this. And George Tenet has released a statement. I'm sure you've seen it. And one of the things that he says – he says this source that you described, this Iraqi guy, Habush, had really nothing new to offer. And it also says that he failed to persuade his British interlocutors that there was anything new here. Now, that seems to directly contradict what you heard on the record from Richard Dearlove, the chief British official.
I would suggest people simply read Dearlove's comments and Nigel Inkster's comments, Peter Dearlove's deputy. They're on the record. They remember vividly what was going on. Tenet has talked often to reporters, even folks in Congress, that he doesn't remember anything. You know, he's got a memory issue, obviously. And the people just shrug. Is it convenient? Is it something else? In any event, I think Tenet is, you know, with the White House because I think both of them are a bit in the same leaky rowboat on this one.
Okay, but the question did occur to me that if the British, in fact, found Habush, this chief of Iraqi intelligence, believable in telling them that there really were no weapons of mass destruction, wouldn't the British have urged caution? Might they have backed out of the coalition? I mean, didn't Tony Blair hear this?
Well, he did hear it, and there was some talk of that. There's no doubt about it. And Rob Richer, our guy, head of our Mideast division, says, you know, look, it was a bit of a trap. We were asking Habush to prove that weapons he said don't exist actually don't exist. It's a prove the negative kind of nightmare. We kind of pushed him, Rob says, into that hole, and we fell in behind him. He says we weren't very creative in figuring out ways that we could prove the things he was saying. And other people talk about that too, that deep down there was a desire by the U.S. to kind of run away from this. This is the last thing we want to hear at this point. Now, having said that, you know, part of the issue here is the nature of doubt. Clearly, Habush at this point arrives in 2003. The whole case for WMD was at that point a very, very rickety structure, you know, about to fall. It was already teetering. Habush kind of kicks it over at that point. And the U.S. government kind of says, it's not pertinent to us. We're going forward. Interesting, Richard Dearlove says something that's quite incisive. He says that he felt the information arrived about Habush to the U.S. at a time that was too late for Cheney, because Cheney, he said, was so ferociously ardent about going to war no matter what. But he says quite firmly, Dearlove does, and this is the view I think of the British, it wasn't too late for Bush. It's really quite dramatic, actually.
Well, what does that tell you, that Bush didn't get this in the same unvarnished way that Cheney did?
Well, I think it says that maybe Dearlove's opinion and the British opinion was that Bush didn't stand up to Cheney in ways that the British feel would be befitting a president.
There's one other little piece of this that I think we ought to explore a bit that relates to the case for war and whether there were weapons of mass destruction. And this was an entirely different Iraqi official, their last foreign minister for Saddam Hussein, Naji Sabri. And the context there were indirect, as I understand it. I mean, he met with U.S. intelligence officials or I guess through an intermediary.
Yeah,
passed
not directly,
along information.
No.
Right. And what was the story that he told?
Well, he was the foreign minister, and he sort of danced around and he talked to an intermediary saying he wants to tell us that there's no WMD. He's more of a diplomat. He's not an intelligence guy like Habush. But in any event, that sort of filtered report did come to the United States in the fall of 2002. What we did is we reshaped it and kind of turned it on its head. It ends up being almost the opposite of what Sabri said, that there were no WMD.
We meaning the
we,
American
the U.S.
government. Yeah.
That's right. By the time it gets to our best friends, the British, it's essentially a 180-degree turn. Later, Michael Shipster himself, the British James Bond on this, meets with CIA officials in 2006, and he's quite aggrieved. He's about to leave the British service at that point. And he says, you know, had you guys not faked us out on Sabri and told us straight that Sabri was saying there was no WMD, by the time Habush arrived, it would have been absolutely definitive and impossible for us to go forward with those two guys together. What's interesting about that is that the United States, of course, knew about both men and what they were really saying, as well as other parts that I lay out in the book.
And just to be clear about this, as in discussing this Iraqi foreign minister, what you're saying is that the United States deliberately misrepresented the information he had, however credible. And instead of it being the message that Saddam Hussein doesn't have WMD, it went over to the British as exactly the opposite, therefore limiting the context that they had for viewing the later revelations.
Precisely.
Right.
And so when they see it all clearly by 2006, when the Sabri disclosure comes out. Again, it's only knee-high to the Habush story, but still it's a little thing that niggled and upset them. They said, my goodness, Shipster himself, if we knew about Sabri, by the time Habush arrives, it would have been essentially a no-question issue. We wouldn't have been able to go to war.
And just maybe to belabor this point just a little bit, if you're the Americans and you were in a situation where an Iraqi official is coming to you offering something. Obviously, we know now there were no weapons of mass destruction, but at the time there was doubt about it. Why wouldn't they have suspected that this was simply disinformation from Saddam Hussein? Should they have known that it was credible?
It's all laid out in the book. People debating that. Is it disinformation? Is it what they call D&D, denial and deception? Is he the real McCoy? It was a real hot potato going around the government. I think what's important here in terms of context to note is that this is intelligence. You know, it's a lot of guesswork and shades of gray and all of the rest. And one of the things that's fascinating, though, is had we continued to dig deep and maybe worked harder to prove whether Habush was saying something that could be proven and verified, you know, imagine if the president at his State of the Union address there in January of 2003, instead of offering the 16 words about uranium from Niger and British intelligence and whatnot, said, you know, we have recently learned that there may not be any WMD in Iraq. You know, at that point, we would have had a real discussion about whether or not to go to war. What are the good enough reasons? Are they good enough reasons for both the U.S. Populace, especially, you know, as well as some of the world community? That discussion was in a way the one that should have happened at this point and probably would have happened, I think, with most previous presidents But it doesn't happen here. And now, years later, we look at this situation as we return to Afghanistan, now boiling over. Pakistan, the tribal areas, bin Laden, Zawahiri, still in force, and a reconstituted al-Qaeda. People are saying, now, why weren't we given the real choice of what the government officials actually knew about the case for war, about what was going through their heads, so we as an American public could decide now that there are 4,000 dead, 19,000 folks, maimed, amputees, enormous blood and treasure spilled, and crucially, America's moral authority in the world profoundly compromised now 5 years later.
So it's after this Iraqi intelligence chief, Habush, has been resettled in Jordan, and after the invasion of Iraq has occurred, and inspectors are not finding weapons of mass destruction, that his name becomes associated with this very troubling story that emerges in your book of a fabricated document appearing to link Saddam Hussein and the 9/11 attacks. Tell us about this document and where it came from.
Well, this part of the story, there are a couple of folks who are on the record witnesses to this part. It's interesting because during the summer, they're fearful that Habush will pop up on the screen. That's something John McGuire says in the book, who's a CIA Iraq chief, because the case for war based on WMD is sort of unraveled in public. And, of course, Habush is their worst nightmare in that way. He told us ahead of time. And so they pay him the $5 million. But then as the summer progresses, and we really don't do anything to Habush, in the fall, September, the White House figures out something that he might be useful for, some way to use him. And that ends up being the Habush letter, which people are very, very interested in these days. And what it is basically a one-stop shop. You know, John McGuire calls it a check the box for all of the White House's problems. The letter, ostensibly fabricated, would be from Habush, backdated July 1st, 2001, to Saddam Hussein, a handwritten letter which talks about the fact that Mohammed Atta, the 9/11 hijacker, trained in Iraq months before 9/11. So that establishes the Saddam al-Qaeda link, which the administration is so interested in. And also that Saddam is actively out buying yellow cake from Niger with the help of a small group from the al-Qaeda organization. This is an assignment. George Tenet, Rob Richer recalls, comes back at one point from a meeting at the White House.
George Tenet, the director of the
CIA.
George
Tenet,
right?
The director of the CIA. Richer recalls him returning from, again, it's all on the record and much of this is taped, coming back from a meeting with an assignment. He remembers the creamy stationery and whatnot. And Tenet says something like, he says something like, "Hey, Marine, you're not going to like this." That's sort of Richard's rendition. And Richard is sort of quizzical about it. You know, this is certainly not the kind of thing CIA tends to do, but it's an order from the White House to Tenet that he just passes down the chain. Richard then turns to John McGuire at some point in this few days here.
And he's the other
he's
CIA.
Head of Iraq, but he's leaving at this point. But they discuss the letter. And that's in the book too, their discussion and what McGuire thought about it. And then it simply goes down the chain, frankly. McGuire's not involved in the execution, but again, these two guys recall this letter being passed from the White House, and it's passed down.
Just to summarize here, Ron, so what we're talking about is a written assignment from the White House on White House stationery to the CIA to have a document fabricated which would be allegedly signed by this Iraqi intelligence chief in the months leading up to 9/11 with all of this false information about Iraq and 9/11 and attempts to acquire uranium from Africa.
That's right. And then it will pop up somewhere in Baghdad, and then it will go into the bloodstream of the global news cycle.
Now, before we get to that, let's go over exactly how we know that this came from the White House. Now, your book has on-the-record statements from these two former CIA officials, Rob Richer and John McGuire. And, of course, since the book has come out, they've released statements. And I'm going to read this for our audience.
Yeah, it's kind of a duck and back away. But mind you, when they hear the statement, this is a statement written by Richer where he made a call actually offering some misinformation to McGuire, who's off far away now And then Richard wrote up the statement. He clearly was under some sort of pressure, and this is how it reads, and I guess you've got it there, Dave.
Yeah, let's listen to this. This is Rob Richard, the guy who you quote on the record in the book. He says, "I never received direction from George Tenet or anyone else in my chain of command to fabricate a document from Habush as outlined in Mr. Susskind's book." And then the statement from John McGuire, the other CIA official, is rendered through Rob Richard. And as Rob Richard reports, McGuire says, "I never received any instruction from then Chief Rob Richard or any other officer in my chain of command instructing me to fabricate such a letter. Further, I have no knowledge to the origins of the letter and as to how it circulated in Iraq." Now, I went back after these statements appeared and looked carefully at how the story unfolds in your book. And it seems to me that the quotes that are attributed to these gentlemen in the book and their statements now are irreconcilable. You agree?
Well, it's if you look at that second statement from McGuire, actually McGuire was never in the book. It's never suggested he's involved in the fabricating of the letter or the execution of it. It says McGuire hears about it. They talk about it. But McGuire's leaving. He's leaving his current job to go back to Baghdad. And the book says all of the issues of the logistics, which, of course, McGuire says in the letter he never did. Well, of course not. It went to his successor. That's what it does say in the book. So what's interesting about
let me just cut in on this point, Ron, because on page 380, you say that looking back, McGuire shakes his head, quote, "incredible arrogance in the face of facts and reality from start to finish, and even making us create fabrications like that Habush letter." We have him quoted as acknowledging that he and the agency were forced to create a fabricated letter. It sure sounds like he's now denying that.
Well, you know, what happened was is that Richard relayed to McGuire in an email some things that were wild-eyed that McGuire never says in the book, that he was the fabricator of the letter. He delivered it. It was all his sort of thing. And McGuire, who's out there in the hustings, you know, here this guy's in a tough spot because he sees this thing roiling the global news cycles. His name's in it, but he doesn't have the book. He's far away. So Richard recounted that for McGuire. John McGuire and I have exchanged some emails, and he realizes that this sort of occurred. And he's getting the book. He's going to get a chance probably to read it tomorrow so he can see that in the book it's exactly what he said to me, which it is, in fact.
And have you communicated with Rob Richard about any of this?
Well, Richard is an interesting situation. Look, the fact is these two guys are saying things that could result going forward in the impeachment of the president. It's a very rare situation we have here. You know, they don't have immunity. It's not under oath in front of some Senate committee or House committee. And enormous pressure has been brought to bear, clearly on Richard. He was fine. He had read the book. We talked about that the morning after. He got it on Monday night. It was out Tuesday morning for the rest of the country. And we talked about it after he read the key sections. And, you know, he was fine with it, frankly. We talked about the kinds of statements he might make. He was getting calls from reporters. All was well. And he sort of said, "I'll say no comment, but Ron Susskind is a fine journalist," that kind of thing, because he didn't want to elaborate on the things he says in the book. He knows that I've taped a lot of the conversations and all the rest. But by the afternoon, something had occurred. Other reporters who had been talking to Richard noticed this as well, that he was jumpy and not himself, really. And at that point, he sent out this statement and sort of, you know, dove deep after that. And that was the last time anyone, I think, has had contact with him. So I'm not sure who's talking to Richard in the late afternoon, Tuesday, before he sends a statement. Frankly, it's the kind of thing some investigator in Congress might someday want to look into, you know, as this thing unfolds, because it's going to be, you know, contentious and tendentious politically, especially in an election season. And ultimately, you feel, you know, a kind of humbleness as a reporter saying, you know, there's some things that books can take you up to the gates of, up to the precipice of, but can't go all the way, just in terms of these issues of people having to testify under oath, hopefully with immunity, and also threat of perjury. That's kind of the way we go through these things. And some people in Congress, of course, are getting ready to do that at this point.
Well, and one person that people are going to want to talk to is you. Are you prepared to play recordings which substantiate what you have in this book?
If it comes to that, of course. I would hope it wouldn't, frankly. And my estimation is that everything in this book is true and findable, and other reporters are out on the hunt right now. There are other sources that are near to the surface, let's just say. And I think lots of these things will be moot fairly quickly. I have not a shadow of a doubt, having spent hours with McGuire and Richard and others. You know, Buzzy Krongard, the number three guy at CIA, talks also about some of these issues of Habush. Other people in the know bits about it. I have no doubt that everything in the book is absolutely accurate.
And before we move on, I want to get to the rest of the Habush story and this document. But as a journalist, and you know, you're not some hack who's come up with the scoop here. You have a long record. You've won a Pulitzer Prize. But if in one of the most controversial parts of the book, one which, as you say, could have grave legal implications, two of the most prominent on-the-record sources are saying it's just not true, what do you say to those who say, why should we believe other parts of the book?
You know, this is actually, sadly, the way the world works. These guys are under stress. This sometimes happens when that's the case. And I think people are looking at it in terms of the context of the situation, which, you know, I've been at this for a long time, and I have sources who spend a lot of time with me. We tape their conversations. I put it in a book or a magazine piece. And then the heat comes of public attention, and it's startling for them, especially at the beginning. You know, it's quite jarring. I'm used to it, but for private citizens, even tough guys like both of these are, and both of them, frankly, are big believers in the truth process. And I've talked to both of them about, hey, you're never going to feel heat quite like this. And they said, both of them, Richer and McGuire, I'm ready to go in front of Senate committees and House committees. I'm ready to have my moment. They knew everything that was in the book. You know, once they get there and the moment arrives, sometimes their knees buckle. And then you kind of say, all right, let's take a deep breath, and you get them upright. And they tend to often then walk forward. So it's dynamic. We're in the process now. They're reacting to that first blast. And McGuire also is getting a chance finally to read the book in the next few days, far away, so he can see in it. It's exactly, and it is, exactly as he expected it to be.
Whatever the origins of the document, which bore the name of this Iraqi intelligence chief, Habush, it's clear that a document was manufactured by somebody. It did get, quote, discovered in Iraq. How did that happen?
Well, it's interesting because it pops up inside of the interim government's files. They're going through documents at that point, and it ends up in the office of Ayad Alawi, who at that point is a member of the interim government, soon to be its first head. And one of his assistants, he talks to a journalist named Con Coughlin from London, a journalist at the Daily Telegraph, and tells him about this extraordinary handwritten letter. And one of Alawi's assistants gives it to Coughlin, and Coughlin writes the story in the London Telegraph, which roils the global news cycles for the coming week. You know, everyone is brought into it. Tom Brokaw talks about it on Meet the Press. William Safire writes a column. Bill O'Reilly is out there flogging it for 4 or 5 days. CNN, it's everywhere. And then after a while, people sort of look at it and scratch their head and say, geez, this is an awful lot in one little letter, isn't it? Solving several problems at once. It seems, even though it does solve all of the White House's problems instantly, in terms of, you know, the connection to Saddam Hussein, between al-Qaeda and Saddam, and Yellow Cake from Niger, it seems a little too perfect and convenient. And that's when people start to doubt it.
And was it publicly discredited eventually?
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting. It just kind of died. People sort of scratched their head and said, this doesn't pass the smell test. And then it sort of listed along, and it pops up a little bit here and there, but it lost its power there after that first week when it was front and center.
Now, the other issue that you raise in the book is that if this document was indeed fabricated by the CIA, as as your sources say,
right,
and it was intended to influence American public opinion. There's a legal problem here, right?
There is. The statutes that formed the CIA that created in 1947 and the amendments, key amendments in 1991, state emphatically that the CIA cannot be used to run disinformation campaigns on the American people. This would qualify as that. I even have actually Rob Richer and John McGuire discussing this in the book. They talk about the legal issues, you know, where the line is drawn. Richer says, well, it was intended to affect the Iraqi public opinion on WMD. And, of course, McGuire counters him rather forcefully, saying people in Iraq, McGuire's been there for years, 13 years in Iraq and back. He says no one cared about WMD in Iraq. It was clearly to solve political problems in the United States. And beyond that, you know, frankly, the CIA is not much in the business of solving the White House's political problems. And McGuire, again, in the book, calls it a check-the-box solution, checking each box that the White House was concerned about all in one letter.
One more question about the origin of the fabricated document. Your sources tell you that the assignment to fabricate this document was given to the CIA on creamy White House stationery.
That's Richard's memory of it as he stood with Tenet.
Right. And the question I wanted to ask was, is it clear who at the White House conveyed this assignment to Tenet?
Well, it's interesting because Richer sort of talks about the fact that the vice president's office was throwing things at them one after another at CIA, prove this, find that, do this. And he says, in a quote, he says, but this was different. This was a deception. I don't go through the process of playing a name game inside of the White Building on this one. I say it's from the White House. That's clear. And it's for, ultimately, I would imagine, investigators, again, with subpoena power and testimony under threat of perjury to find out exactly how that would work inside of the White House. Now, mind you, importantly, though, that George Tenet is not going to be given an order for a mission, especially one like this that's contentious, and not generally in the character of the CIA. He's not going to be taking an order about a mission like that from anyone other than a senior-most official. It simply won't happen. A third or fourth-rung person does not order the director of Central Intelligence to do anything. And that, of course, is how it is remembered in the book by the participants as an order from the White House that was passed the CIA for execution.
You know, apart from the statements of these folks that you quoted, the White House itself issued a statement and says, among other things, the idea that the White House had anything to do with a forged letter purportedly from Habush to Saddam is absurd. What do you make of that response?
Well, you know, it's the kind of thing, actually, you know, when you're in this business for a while, you start to get a feel for the way statements really look and what they really mean. There's a lot of things that are sort of subtly not quite right. And even in some of Rob Richer's stuff that he pulled together, I think, as some reporters told me, kind of in a panic, you know, it doesn't actually deal with the issue directly. It deals with something that's sort of not being asked.
Do you mean by that they don't actually say it didn't happen? They instead
well,
say that it's
as
absurd?
It's not as clear as it seems. You know, Rob, the chain of command is a complex issue. You know, Rob is not – I didn't forge. Well, Rob is not a guy at the head of a division who would ever forge anything. You know, you got to look at the parsing of the language like lawyers do. People in public don't. They say, oh, that's a denial. But a lawyer constructing something can make it seem like a denial, but it's not quite as hard and fast as one might think. And all over town reporters – you know, have heard the, oh, that couldn't be true, that's ridiculous, especially in some cases when reporters have called up to say, or their lawyers at news organizations, is my reporter being wiretapped, frankly? Oh, we would never do such a thing. That's utterly ridiculous. Well, that's not exactly the same thing as absolutely not. We've checked and we absolutely know that this never happened. That's a different thing.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with journalist Ron Suskind. His new book is The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism. I want to talk just a little bit about this Fascinating episode you describe in the summer of 2006, when President Bush is very anxious about some intelligence briefings that he is getting from the British. What are they telling him?
Well, in late July of 2006, the British are moving forward on a mission they've been – an investigation they've been at for a year at that point, where they've got a group of plotters, so-called, in the London area that they've been tracking. And it's starting to come to a bit of fruition, a little forward progress in that late summer of 06, where it's clear from these guys are wired right down to their shorts. You know, they've got piles of wiretap information. They can't do anything without being tracked. But it starts to become clear that their plan is for planes to come from the UK with bombs for the United States. At least that's what they're kind of talking about. Well, Bush gets this briefing at the end of July of 2006, and he's very agitated. When Blair comes at the end of the month, they talk about it, and he says, look, I want this thing, this trap snap shut immediately. And Blair's like, well, look, be patient here. What we do in Britain, Blair describes, and this is something well known to Bush, is we try to be more patient. So they move a bit forward. These guys are not going to breathe without us knowing it. We've got them all mapped out so that we can get actual hard evidence and then prosecute them in public courts of law and get real prosecutions and long prison terms. That's the British way. And this is really their emblematic investigation. They've really thousands of people involved in it on the British side. Well, Bush doesn't get the answer he wants, which is snap the trap shut. And the reason he wants that is because he's getting all sorts of pressure from Republicans in Congress that his ratings are down. These are the worst ratings for a sitting president at this point in his second term. And they're just wild-eyed about the coming midterm elections. Well, Bush expresses his dissatisfaction to Cheney as to the Blair meeting, and Cheney moves forward.
So you got the British saying, let's carefully build our case, let's get more intelligence. Bush wants an arrest and a political win. What does he do?
Absolutely. What happens is that then, a few days later, the CIA operations chief, which is really a senior guy, he's up there in the 1, 2, 3 spots at CIA, a guy named Jose Rodriguez, ends up slipping quietly into Islamabad, Pakistan, and he meets secretly with the ISI, which is the Pakistani Intelligence Service. And suddenly, a guy in Pakistan named Rashid Rauf, who's kind of the contact of the British plotters in Pakistan, gets arrested. This, of course, as anyone could expect, triggers a reaction in London, a lot of scurrying, and the Brits have to run through the night wild-eyed and basically round up 25 or 30 people. It's quite a frenzy. The British are livid about this. They talk to the Americans. The Americans kind of shrug. Who knows? You know, ISI picked up Rashid Rauf.
So the British did not even get a heads up from the United States that this arrest was going to happen?
Did not get a heads up. In fact, the whole point was to mislead the British. You know, what Jose Rodriguez was worried about slipping into Islamabad is alerting the British, because we wanted this done and we didn't want any fingerprints. And of course, that's exactly what happens. The British did not know about it, frankly, until I reported it in the book and I talked to some of them, and they kind of said, oh, you know, after all these years, you know, we got a kind of a shrug from the Americans, a non-denial denial, if you will, and now we know the truth. What's interesting is that the White House already had its media plan already laid out before all of this occurred, so that the president and vice president immediately, even in Cheney's case, before the arrest, the day before, started to capitalize on the war on terror rhetoric and political harvest, which, of course, they use for weeks to come right into the fall, about the worst plot since 9/11 that has been foiled. And this is why you want us in power.
And did the British believe that the United States acting precipitously damaged their efforts to combat terrorism in the UK?
What's interesting is that now, years later, this trial of these British plotters, the airline plotters, has just come to completion. It's exactly what the British predicted. that the trigger was pulled too early and the evidence was not yet ripe. And these plotters have claimed that they weren't serious. They were doing a kind of demonstration, like a public kind of a protest of sorts, that they weren't actually going to go through with this plot. All the sorts of things that undercut exactly what the British were worried about, that they wouldn't have the evidence to carry through meaningful prosecutions and put them away for a long time. That actually unfolded just this summer.
Well, Ron Suskind, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Dave.
Ron Suskind's new book is The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism. You can read the prologue to his book on our website, freshair.npr.org.